Good morning, Maine. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. You heard it right. WLOB, 1310 a.m. It's good to be here. How you doing, Deb?
I'm good. How are you?
What a show we have today.
Amazing.
Amazing show. We taped it about a week or two ago. We had our good friend Elliot Cutler in the studio.
Yep.
Which is really the first time I'd sat down with Elliot for any time. Did I ever tell you when I went and met with him? It was about a year ago, and I had this crazy idea that I was going to run for governor. I didn't think it was crazy, but clearly the voters reacted in that way. So Elliot was announced as a candidate. Obviously, later on, Mike Michoud entered the race, and then I ultimately support him. But before Mike Michoud decided to run, I feel strongly about our state, and I went to see Elliot Cutler. He kept calling me by a different name.
He did not.
Well, he did.
What did he call you?
It was like, I have a brother. And he was like, oh, yeah. Hey, how you doing there, Peter? And that's not my brother's name, but I go, my name's Steve. He goes, oh, good seeing you. Good seeing you, Peter. And I'm like, what?
He must think that you look like a Peter.
Yeah. No, he was, I disagreed with Elliot staying in the last gubernatorial race when it seemed like it was just not going to happen.
Yeah.
But I respect his accomplishments, and he has a new role as CEO of this new graduate group that's part of the UMaine system that's going to hopefully streamline things with the graduate schools, and it also will involve, I believe, the UMaine Law School.
Right.
And so let's get to that interview.
All right.
My interview with former two-time gubernatorial candidate Elliot Cutler. Lawyers, guns, and money. Those are all the essentials. Welcome to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. Please join me in welcoming a very special guest, Mr. Elliot Cutler. Good morning,
it's
Elliot.
It's great to be here. It's great to be on LOB again. It's been a long time.
Yeah. 50,000. Is it 50,000 or 5 million watts of just power pulsating
either,
through
either
the...
Either will do.
Whatever.
And it's mostly person-driven, too.
It's person-driven. But also, since we're on the internet, there's 8 billion potential listeners.
You have no idea how many times I've heard that.
Yes, I know, but don't be...
Billions of people out there.
You never know.
You never know who's going to stumble on either one of us.
I know. It happens all the time.
Given how big the two of us are together, we could be the...
Are you talking about weight mass? Because I'm talking about general mass. I'm a large man. I know
so
that.
Am I,
if
man.
You were rubbing that in.
No, no, no. It's two of us.
Okay, together.
Together.
Okay. Well, the formal introduction, I think anyone in Maine who's been here for any amount of time is familiar with Elliot Cutler. He's been...
Perhaps overly.
I wouldn't say that. Mr. Cutler has played an important role over the last 5 years relative to two gubernatorial campaigns where he brought up a number of issues. He ran as an independent. He is also a noted attorney with a long career in the law, and most recently he had made news as taking a new position with to unify the law schools and the UMaine system and to try to help our economy through the academic institutions, which I certainly want to talk to. But before we get to that, how are you doing today, Elliot?
Great. Terrific.
Really?
Yeah. No, I'm having a – you know why?
Why?
Because Melanie and I are going down to Boston this afternoon with two of our good friends to hear Bette Midler in concert at TD Center. And if you're as old as I am, Bette Midler is a big deal.
Deb, right there.
She can still belt out a song.
Oh, she's fabulous.
Yeah.
You ever
her new CD with a doo-wop, the girls' groups?
Oh,
it's great. It's fabulous.
Yeah. You ever watch the movie The Rose? It's kind of a classic.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Where she was
well, the
like,
song's a classic.
Classic, but she was kind of channeling Janis Joplin. It was a loose kind of depiction of Janis Joplin. And,
very loose.
And very, very loose, very loose. But what
Isn't
an
that how Janis was?
Very loose. So that's how Bette was. So you put loose times loose and you get loose squared.
There you go.
Well, Deb, that's your Jeopardy category, right?
Yes.
Loose musical artist is Deb Elliott.
Yeah. You got it, baby.
Yeah, Debbie Davis for 20 points.
Actually, it's Claire Booth loose for her.
Anything in the loose category, Deb is an expert. Hey, I wanted to, obviously the big news, and I think the focus of what I want to talk to you about today is your new position and the work that's happening in the Maine Center for Graduate Professional Studies. But I think you and I over the years in kind of political realms have agreed on quite a bit, and we may have disagreed on a couple things, but I think we both are unified in our interest and love of Maine and also the need to really do something about what has fundamentally been a weak economic engine. And I believe education is one of the key fuels for that. So I support your role and what's going on. But before we do that, I think that many of our listeners, and certainly Deb, was curious, coming out of the last gubernatorial election. I wanted to talk about that briefly. I know something about losing elections. Deb reminds me every week. I go off into some subject. I come in here in a happy mood, and then Deb says, "Hey, let's go through the voting records and let's see how many people voted on, you know, for this last election." She's
well, you know them all by name, right?
Well, all four of them. Yeah, I definitely know the four people who have traditionally voted for me. You've had many more people vote for you, so I'm sure it's bigger.
It's only because I stuck around longer.
Yeah, but I wanted to ask you a couple of things. One, it's both timely and topical. When you were running for governor in this last election, you ran as an independent against Mike Michaud, the Democrat, and the prevailing candidate, re-election of Paul LePage. There was lots of speculation, some of it by me, but there were lots of speculation relative to the spoiler thing. And I think you've articulated your position well, so I don't want to make you kind of rehash that in terms of, you know, a democracy, an elected representative government requires the burden for the voters to make their choice, and every vote counts. And I don't want to speak for you, but I thought your view was you didn't see it as a spoiler rule. You saw it as it's up to the voters. And if the voters wanted to select you or Mike Michaud, and in the last few days of the campaign, if the voters thought that there was more momentum going for Mike or Paul, then your voters would make that. Looking in retrospect, which is always fun on radio and always fun in the media, do you feel as though the ultimate choice, especially with what we're going through right now with in terms of our state government and talks of shutdown and talks of Paul LePage breaking every veto record known to man, it's almost like he's on a quest to break every veto record, that you would have proceeded in the same way that you did, or with the benefit of hindsight, let me just be blunt. Do you wish that you took the $10,000 I offered a week before, you know, the election, saying, "My dear,
I didn't know you did.
You really didn't." Well, geez, Deb, you were supposed to send the note over there.
Oh, I forgot. I'm sorry.
No, I wrote a column.
So Ray ate it.
I wrote a column to my five readers in my column saying, "Dear Elliot, I love your campaign. I think that you're eminently qualified, but it does not look like you're going to make it. Take the $10,000, not that you need it personally, you're a man of wealth and means, but I said, donate it to a charity, and let's try," and obviously I did it with the bias of I supported Mike Michaud because I thought that he would be best for Maine as opposed to the other choice, which is ultimately being somewhat destructive. But if you had known, if I made it $15,000, what's the number? Because we can't go back. But are you happy with the way it played out in terms of...
Well, I'm not happy I lost.
Well, yeah.
But look, you know, first of all, let me make two or three points. First of all, my view was that voters deserve a choice. I wasn't prepared to vote for either Paul LePage or Michael Michaud for governor. I didn't think either one of them was qualified to pull Maine out of the mess we're in. And why would I deny voters a choice, a third choice, which was important, I thought, for every voter to have? Secondly, the conventional wisdom, at least for a while, was that a vote for me was a vote for LePage. That is, that I was a spoiler who might ensure LePage's reelection. The interesting fact is that out of all the exit polls that were taken on election day, it was clear that had I not been in the race, LePage would have won by an even bigger margin. So it wasn't me denying Michael Michaud a chance to be governor of Maine. I didn't think Mike Michaud was qualified to be governor of Maine, and I still don't believe he was. So, no, I don't regret anything. I think voters deserve choice, and I was giving it to them.
Were you surprised on election night when the governor came up on the stage and he was very effusive in his praise for you, and he suggested he may have been in the heat of the moment or the euphoria of the balloons popping, but geez, he went into the thing. I thought he was going to be gracious and not only recognize you but recognize Mike Michaud and say, hey, I wish them both. But he kind of cut off Mike Michaud's, you know, conciliatory speech, and then he went into, there's one man in Maine I really want to really thank, and I'm thinking, oh, this is very kind. Mike Michaud just gave up a three-decade political career in Maine, and now he's, you know, they took away his congressional car, and all of a sudden, he obviously there's pain associated with it. And I thought, this is nice. He's going to say something classy about, you know, Congressman Michaud, who is still, at that point, a sitting congressman. But instead, he went into this thing about his good friend Elliot Cutler and how much respect he had for you. And if he could be king, which is part of his aspirational goals, he would make you the attorney general. He would take Janet Mills out of there with the jaws of life. And it really sounded. And then during the campaign, at one point, I don't think you guys hugged, but you had a high five. People called it a little bit of a bromance, and I don't think you initiated anything, but were you surprised?
Oh, I've been surprised over and over and over again by things the governor has said. I mean, over years now, 6 years. So no, I wasn't. I mean, I was taken aback, but you know, I didn't think twice about it afterwards. I haven't spoken with him since. You know, but that the high five in the debate, which was, you know, a moment when it was just a normal human reaction. The high five in the debate and what he said on election night fueled the notion that I was in this race in order to ensure his reelection, which was the furthest thing from the truth. No one was more critical of Paul LePage and his record than I was. I was the guy who exposed the whole Kate Street thing long before the Portland Press Herald ever picked it up. And gave the governor a really hard time about that and all kinds of other things. And what I've said to people who say that this was, you know, that what he said that night was a payback for all the help I'd given him. What I've said about that is, look, you know, if that was payback, this was the lousiest return on investment of any investment I've ever made in my life. It surprised me. I've known him now for 6 years. We've been through two campaigns together. You get to know somebody after that.
Speaking of Kate Street, I think that's a fascinating subject, and it's probably closer events than moving on from the last election. You were one of the voices of reason years ago when that bill passed the state legislature, and I think that you kind of, I don't know, I'm going to call you the canary in the coal mine, but you at least rang the bell saying, this doesn't feel right. And then for listeners that may or may not be up to speed, what's happened, and is a quick synopsis, a bill passed in the state legislature, and it had to do with Kate Street and Great Northern Paper, and it had to do with some financial smart guys in Louisiana, and a whole bunch of attorneys, which was a shock to everyone that attorneys were involved. And the net result was approximately $16 million of taxpayer money from the state budget will effectively be lost through these transactions. And the thing that concerned me the most was the reaction from Augusta, where it passed and the result happened, and many of the state legislators were like, we just weren't sophisticated enough. And I wrote a column a few weeks ago saying that was a kind way of saying that you were over your head or you weren't smart enough, or out of the 13 members, and again, that's may or may not be exactly accurate, nobody had experience in law, finance, business. And I don't doubt anyone's willingness to serve in whether it's local government. I was on Yarmouth Town Council for 4 years, or county or state. And I think citizen government requires people, but you need to have competency. There's this consequence to putting people in these roles that have no experience. Talk a little bit about Kate Street and what you saw then and what kind of cautionary tale resulted in what happened, and how you think things could be better so that kind of thing doesn't happen again in our state government.
The bill that passed the legislature passed that enabled what are called state new market tax credits passed several years ago, and the Kate Street deal was made during the first of Paula Page's terms as governor. And during this campaign, the last campaign, I pointed out that it was a bad deal for Maine taxpayers for the reasons that you mentioned. We sent $16 million out of state to a bunch of passive investors and ended up basically creating no jobs. The whole transaction reflected a missing sense of vision about Maine's future and a desperate effort to restore industries that have, I think, in many respects, seen their best days in the past in Maine. And that sense of desperation leads to bad decisions. Secondly, I think the legislature, as you pointed out, is ill-equipped to deal with measures like this. They don't have enough staff. They don't have enough experience themselves. They're not sufficiently informed. And so they make judgments, make decisions that they later regret. And I think this was a case of that happening. And finally, the state agencies that permitted this to happen, too many of the board members who participated in the decision, certainly not all of them, many of them objected to it, but some of the board members who participated in the decision and led the way were doing so, by all appearances, for the wrong reasons. And this was a disaster. And it should suggest that the legislature needs more staff, needs better staff, and we need to take much greater care of the public's money.
Well, what about the issue of competency? And, you know, that's something that I've been talking about, again, to my three listeners and four readers of my column. You certainly have a broader megaphone on this issue. I've talked about, you know, in Maine, our biennial budget is about $6 billion. It's about $3 billion a year. Local government budgets are significant. In Yarmouth, my hometown, it's over $30 million. Falmouth, Portland, 50 or almost $300 million. The money is connected to a very, very detailed, complex process involving labor contracts, engineering, healthcare initiatives, some things that are technical. And somehow here in Maine, more so than other parts around the country, I think we've gotten away from the idea of valuing competency in government. And I used an example during my campaign where if you fell off the chair right here, Elliot, first of all, I would feel bad. And if that happened, we certainly don't want that. But the immediate thing, you're an educated man, you're a smart guy, your immediate thing would be like, well, my leg is broken. I need to kind of do something about it. And I'd say, hey, Elliot, I think maybe an ambulance would be a competent way of getting you to Maine Med. And you go, yep. Maine Med is a competent place to treat an injury. You'd go, yeah. And then through your screams, you'd be yelling something about needing an anesthesiologist, which represents competency.
Well, I'd also want a lawyer because I'd be getting ready to sue you.
Yeah. Well, I've reinforced the chair. You'll notice that the chair you're sitting on has special reinforcement because I've wanted to preempt this whole thing. But when it's something like that, we recognize competency. You get on an airplane, you recognize the guy or gal behind the wheel has got FAA certification competency. But somehow we keep electing people and we don't apply the same standards. We think, oh, that person's angry enough. I like them. Or that person's like me. Or that person doesn't care about this. How do we get people to recognize competency in government, which is the root in a democracy of all of our rules, laws, and legislation? It's base camp for health care, for energy, for consumer safety. If we don't have better elected officials, everything else is downstream from that.
Well, one place to start would be to go back to Washington's farewell address and look at all of the warnings that he and other founding fathers gave about political parties. We've permitted a system to grow up where political parties and party affiliation is more important than competency. And until we allow voters more effective choice by giving independents a real opportunity and by leveling the playing field so that party affiliation is not the principal driver of our election decisions, until that happens, we're going to be faced, I think, with candidate after candidate after candidate on both the state level and the national level for whom party affiliation is more important than principles and competence.
How do we break the catch-22 that in order to have that reform, you need the current institutional structure to recognize it, meaning Democrats and Republicans, and they're the ones that are incentivized to keep
the
structure?
Yeah, let me give you an example. There's going to be in 2016 on the ballot in the state of Maine a referendum calling for ranked choice voting. Ranked choice voting will minimize the importance of party affiliation in elections, and it will ensure that Maine has a majority governor coming out of every election, and it will level the playing field for independents. I think it's terribly important. I think Maine voters are going to approve it. We have it in Portland now in mayoral elections, and it worked.
We have Elliot Cutler here in the studio. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O and News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Talk a little bit about growing up in Maine and how that shaped your future as both a lawyer and then a politician and now as the newly hired leader of kind of the combined school at UMaine.
Well, I grew up in Bangor, and, you know, it was, I think, the most formative part of my growing up was not just growing up in Bangor, but it was working with and for Mainers like Ed Muskie. Spending 7 years working for Ed Muskie was the most formative experience of my life outside of my family. And what I learned from him was the value of independent thought and the importance of not being constrained by conventional wisdom, by what had been done before. There's a natural segue, frankly, from that to what I'm doing now, because one of the biggest problems we have in higher education is that we're stuck in a system that is a supply-driven business model. We're doing things the way we've always done them because that's the way we've always done them. And we're teaching knowledge, as you pointed out in an earlier conversation, you're absolutely right, we're teaching knowledge which is becoming increasingly commoditized. What we ought to be teaching is teamwork and collaboration and innovation and innovative thinking, and we're not doing it. If Ed Muskie were here today, he'd be the first to point it out.
Well, let's talk about your new role, and let's talk about the Graduate Center. Let's start with how did this come about, and how are you kind of selected and being part of the process, and then talk a little bit for listeners that may not know the details. What is the mandate of your new role, and what's ultimately the objective for the Graduate Center here in Maine?
Well, let's start with what it is. It's not a merger. It's not a combination. What we're trying to do is take the Maine Law School, the only law school in the state of Maine, the two programs that offer MBA degrees, master's degrees in business administration, one at Orono and one in Portland, and the Muskie School of Public Service, which offers master's degrees in public health and in community planning and development, and bring those programs together in a consortium under one roof, physically co-located, with sufficient scale to attract people, with sufficient curricular flexibility and innovation so that, for example, a lawyer graduates from law school with a JD degree, knowing how to read a balance sheet, knowing how to help a small business person, which is Maine's economic engine, start and grow his or her business. What a dramatic change that would be.
So you mean instead of just figuring out exorbitant billable hours? Wow. This really is. I love lawyers. So, I joke, of course, but I've worked with a lot of
attorneys. Well, you depend on them, don't you?
Well, you depend on them because we are a nation of laws, and when you have a business of any scale,
you're regulated.
Yeah, you're regulated, and I accept that.
And it's a good thing that lawyers know something about business, isn't it?
It's a great thing, because ultimately you don't engage lawyers because you enjoy law or the law and order. You engage it for the purpose of making your business more efficient or helping, saving your business.
So how did this come about? So it starts for me back in January of 2009 when I gave a speech on reforming higher education in the state of Maine. And I made a series of proposals, including merging the two systems and so forth, proposals that were in my book as well. And one of the proposals was to create a graduate center for a center for graduate professional education in Portland to do what we're doing now. When Jim Page became chancellor of the university system, he took on this idea. It was a natural corollary to his idea to create one university instead of seven different universities, each self-governed. And after the election, he called me and asked me if I'd be interested in being the CEO of the new center and creating it because there's no blueprint for it. I have about a year left to come up with the blueprint. And I said, absolutely, I'd love to do it. This is something I care about deeply, and I think it's something that it can't change by itself Maine's future, but it can have an enormous impact on putting us back in the driver's seat for Maine's own economic future. And it's very important in that regard.
I agree. Have you met the new dean designate of the law school, Dean Conway?
I have. Spent a lot of time with her.
Yeah. She was in here 2 weeks ago.
She was great.
Mm-hmm. She, for those that may not
be very dynamic.
Oh, incredibly dynamic. Yep. I think she's already started work, but I think her official deanship begins in July 1st.
July 1.
Yeah. But she came from Hawaii and has a distinguished career both in teaching and practicing law. And the first thing I asked her is, she made the decision. This was kind of unusual. In the middle of February or January, there was a review process. There were a number of candidates. It got whittled down to four. They finally selected her. The chancellor picked her. He called her in January or February. She was in Hawaii and said, hey, would you like to come? Which in itself would be a huge honor. But she came right away. I said, Dean, why? You're in Hawaii in February. You see the weather reports here in Maine. Why wouldn't you just wait to April? She was so eager. She literally got out of plane. I think she's going to be great for the university. I think having new perspective, new insights, she's very enthusiastic. Aside from putting them under one roof, how does the administration of the different disciplines and how does the interaction, is it more about getting the leaders together and kind of getting on the same page, or will there be structural changes that impact the different schools, both the law school and the graduate program?
Well, that's what we have a year to try to figure out, Steve. But I'll tell you that I think the bringing the faculties together and bringing the students together is critically important because the students know in many respects, the students have a better sense of what the employers want than sometimes the faculties do. Now, students, there are law students who know that they need to take a basic accounting course before they graduate. They know it. They know that they need to know how to read a balance sheet. They know that they need to be able to help a small businessman in Lincoln start a new business. They know that. And I think the faculties are beginning to cooperate with each other in teaching collaborative courses. We have a course, for example, this fall. That's being taught by faculty from the Muskie School, the Law School, and the Business School, and by a lot of guest lecturers, including the people who wrote the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. It's a course on environmental law and policy, and I think it's going to attract students not just from the law school, but from the business school and from the Muskie School, because all of these students will be better prepared for today's workplace if they understand sustainability and where it comes from and what laws impact
it. Talk about education in general. With your new role for the graduate system under UMaine, Maine has some great academic institutions, both in terms of the university system, which is under the state umbrella, and then also private colleges here in Maine. But technology has impacted everything over the last two decades, whether it's publishing, entertainment, business itself, and certainly academia, where the old paradigm of lots of big brick buildings and heating systems, air conditioning systems, dorms spread out, kind of decentralized, made sense at one period. But now, as you and I talked about, knowledge is commoditized, and anyone with an iPhone has access to all the data and knowledge that they could ever really need. What do you think about a broader education reform here in Maine? You know, we have about 1.3 million people, 35,385 square miles. So we have a very decentralized, spread out, large state. I've always favored thoughtful consolidation, thoughtful efficiency. New economy wants density and efficiency. Do you think that applies at all to higher education, or do you think we need to kind of make the system work that we have?
Well, I you know, 6 years ago, I proposed that we merge the two systems of higher education. To start with, we have in a state, as you point out, of 1,300,000 people, we have a university system that has seven separate universities in it, public universities. We have a community college system that has seven community colleges in it. Until this past week, there was no agreement between the two systems, no effective agreement between the two systems that allowed people who had gone for 2 years at the community colleges, at one of the community colleges, to easily transfer their credits into the university system. You know, we've made it, and I don't think we've done it purposely, but we've made it difficult and expensive and time-consuming for students to prepare themselves for the workplace. That's not good for students, and it's certainly not good for employers in the state of Maine who have voted, if you will, with their feet by leaving because we don't have an educated workforce, educated in the way that employers need them to be educated. You know, I've often said that when you crest the hill in Presque Isle coming into town and you look out and you see both Northern Maine Community College and the University of Maine at Presque Isle, nestled next to each other,
right.
It is a tableau of what's wrong with our system of higher education in the state of Maine. I think that Jim Page is really, I know that he is working very, very hard to create one university, and he's got to do this sort of around the statute that requires that we have seven campuses, each with its own leader. Well, okay, but we've got to bring these campuses, these universities together in one system where we don't have a lot of duplication and where we have a real focus on Maine's needs and where we can continue to provide high-quality education for students at a price they can afford. It's a terribly important challenge. There's no greater challenge that we need to address in the state because this isn't the chicken and egg thing. It's not a question of, you know, well, if we have businesses, then we'll have educated students. If we don't have educated people, we're not going to have businesses and we're not going to have employment, we're not going to have jobs. We've got to have an educated workforce.
I agree. We have Elliot Cutler here in the studio. Time Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB. Let's get back to law. I'm fascinated with law. You had a long and distinguished career, both in terms of serving with, not serving, but supporting Edward Muskie and also in D.C., a number of law firms. I've always thought that as a nation of laws, and we're organizing our democracy through the Constitution, that everything kind of emanates from law. So as we sit here in the studio, within probably 100 feet or 100 yards or a mile from here, there are thousands of examples, whether it's FDA stuff, whether it's FCC, whether it's automotive safety and the work that Ralph Nader did in the 60s, which created, whether it's EPA. Law is so important. But at some point, What is your feeling about the intersection of law, lawyers, and lobbyists in politics? Because we talked about the recent Kate Street, I'll call it a debacle, but when you go up to Augusta, and I don't want to single out any law firms because I think all the major firms here in Maine have a presence in Augusta. But if we don't have qualified, competent legislators, they're more prone to listen to and take direction from people who they feel are competent. And because there's so many lawyers that are part of the process, it feels like the legal community and the lobbying community here in Maine plays a much bigger role in the direction and the actions of our state legislature. Do you agree with that? Do you think everything's in balance? As a lawyer yourself, I'm sure that you're fond of lawyers and the whole profession, which I have respect for. But is it a problem? Is it a help? Is it something that should be somehow amended?
You know, I've never been a lobbyist. I mean, I think it was enough four times in the course of my legal career that I had to register as a lobbyist because I had to meet with a member of Congress. And if you want to meet with a member of Congress, you have to register as a lobbyist. But I wasn't a lobbyist, and my law firm didn't have a lobbying arm. But lobbying, which in Maine is not just done by lawyers, it's done, in fact, by many people who are not lawyers. Lobbying is, there's nothing illegitimate about lobbying. There's nothing illegitimate about employing representatives to make your case, whether you're a trade association or a group of welfare recipients. It doesn't matter who you are. There's absolutely nothing wrong with employing someone to help you make your case to legislators. The challenge in Maine is making sure that the legislators have an independent source of information and judgment and analysis so that they're not dependent on self-interested presentations by lobbyists. Every lobbyist is going to give you a good and unbiased analysis of the public issue at stake. They're going to represent the interests of whomever is paying them. That's what they ought to do. But we're getting ourselves in trouble, in my view, by not providing our legislators with independent, unbiased, nonpartisan analysis, information, and judgment. They're not well staffed.
I agree. I told the story a few weeks ago, almost 1 year ago. I went to the Democratic convention up in Bangor. And this is probably, I probably need to make a confession here, right, Deb? Is this the part of the program
where? Yeah, this is it.
I registered a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, as a Democrat. I was independent for the last 10 years. My social views are anchored by Democratic principles in terms of people and health care and just treating people well, right? You know, but relative to fiscal matters, I wouldn't describe myself as conservative. I describe myself as practical, where we should do as much as we can to help people as a country in terms of other countries, other states where people are in need, or here within Maine in terms of individuals and communities. But we should do it with a calculator in one hand, and we must come up with systems that we can figure out where the money's coming from, because if we just incur more debt or other instruments of debt or bonds, we're transferring one pain point or one negative into another. But so I went to – so I'm registered as a Democrat. I ran as a Democrat. But I've never been a big fan of the tribe because, you know, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, there's a lot of people who are really rabid. And they're not capable of critical thinking and lucid thought because they're driven. Yeah. I'm talking to, maybe Maine's most recognized independent candidate here. So, yeah, I know I'm preaching the choir. So I went to the Democratic convention. I had my Democratic sticker, and I was cheering, and Shannon Bellows showed up, and we cheered, and Mike showed up, and we cheered, and all this other stuff. There was a breakout session, and it was for people running both candidates and incumbents for legislative office, and it was headed up by, at that time, Senate President Justin Alfond and House Chair Mark Eaves. And there were about four of us in the audience. And there were candidates and incumbents. And it feels bizarre even repeating it, but a woman raised her hand and she said, "I have a question." And, Justin or Mark, you say, "Yeah, what is it?" "Well, I never really even wanted to run. So-and-so on the committee forced me to run. I'm uncontested in my seat," and it was for a state Senate seat. And I'm not going to name the person. And I told them I wasn't good at numbers. And some of these support groups are asking me to fill out forms, and I don't know what the heck is going on with these numbers. And immediately, it was either Mark Eaves or Justin said, "Hey, Freddie over there, who's part of the Democratic support team, will take you out to ballroom C and help you with your forms afterwards." And she said, "Okay, I told you I'd run. I'll run. But I need some help with these fancy numbers." And I'm not saying it to belittle her, but I'm saying it to highlight the fact that the system is broken when a person says, "I'm not good with those numbers," but this woman was part of the most recent, the current budget issue involving billions of dollars, and she's not good with numbers. I don't know how we get to this point, Elliot.
Have you unenrolled yet?
I know the problem. Okay, well, here's the other problem, because I think it's a good question. It's a good issue. Dick Woodbury, who up until this last session 2 years ago was a member of the state Senate, one of 35 members. He was the sole independent, I believe, at that time. And he decided not to run again. And I asked State Senator Dick Woodbury, who I think is a very bright, capable man. He has a background.
He's one of the best people in the state of Maine.
He's a really nice guy. And I think he's been involved with your campaigns possibly. And he's just a really nice guy. So I'm like, "Geez, Dick, why aren't you running?" And I don't want to speak for him, but my recollection is he said, "Well, it's really hard. In theory, being an independent and having an independent voice is fine. But particularly with state legislature, if you're independent," and I think he caucused with the Democrats, but he couldn't get either committee leadership positions and he couldn't sponsor bills. And in effect, he was kind of neutered. And so when you go up to the state house, Democrats are on one side of the Senate chambers, Republicans on the other. And Dick was kind of sitting in the middle, literally and figuratively a lonely man. And the Democrats let him caucus so he could vote on things, but in effect, he couldn't have a leadership position. And given that he's one of the state's, I think, best economists, and I think he understands numbers, the fact that he wasn't given a committee assignment or budget or anything else seemed bizarre. And so I would prefer if we were all independent. If it was like, you know, with Maine's problems, we need 200 of the best and the brightest. Forget about what the party is.
So look, I had to file a lawsuit in federal court in the last election in order to be permitted to raise the same amount of money for our campaign as Democrats and Republicans could raise. We won the lawsuit. But, I mean, to have to go to federal court in order to do that, I mean, this is crazy. If people really want to dilute the influence of the two political, badly performing, at least right now,
right,
political parties. I mean, one way to do it, in my view, is to support ranked choice voting.
I know, but when you said people, this is what bugs me. The last election in the last week, municipality elections, and I'm going to throw some numbers out that are not precise, but in Falmouth, I think 5 or 6% of registered voters voted. In Yarmouth, 4.7%. Cumberland was a similar thing.
These are the school budget votes.
But laws and budgets and who's running, it's an idea. And so off-year elections are like that. But the fact is, democracy is a participation sport. If we don't have people, so you mentioned ranked choice voting, most people don't know the difference between a refrigerator and a referendum. And so if we can't get people understanding basic elements of democracy or local government, county government, state government, it's left to a handful of people that drive the process.
Steve, that's, I think, one of the reasons that this has become the case, to the extent it has, is that an increasing number of people feel disenfranchised. They feel frozen out. They feel like their vote doesn't really matter, that they don't really have choice. I mean, people are looking at the candidates, for example, in the 2016 presidential election, and they're going like, really? This is, we're going to have another Clinton Bush race? I mean, this is what we're going to, you know, I think people feel less and less like effective participants in the democracy. Well, there are a lot of things we need to do to fix that. We need to begin dramatically minimizing the role of money in politics. We need to get money out of politics. We need to provide an effective level playing field for independents. There are a lot of things we need to do. One of the first things we're going to be able to do in Maine is to adopt ranked choice voting. That's a start. It's a long road back, but taking that road back is a lot better, in my view, than continuing on the road in the direction we're going, which is not good.
Yeah, I say that every day. I had one initiative I wanted to kind of push, and it has to do with education, and maybe you could champion my cause here. I believe that knowledge and understanding and insight of at least base-level governmental issues is critical to us evolving out of the current state of the mess. I want to approach every school district in Maine, high school district in Maine, with a proposal. And the proposal is predicated on, I think when people turn 18, young women and young guys turn 18, it is a sacred transition. It is the point where you can vote, a point you can participate in our democratic process. I think it's really kind of a big deal. I think it's a really, really big deal. And about 70% of graduating high school seniors are either 18 or they're about to be 18 for the first municipal election. In most school systems, they teach civics and American history in fifth or sixth grade. By the time we get to these students being in 12th grade, most of them, and I'll say most, people say, oh, that's an exaggeration. No, most graduating seniors, because there's a 3 or 4% voting rate, are just, they're unfamiliar with government. It's intimidating. They don't understand, so they opt out. I want to do something in the last 4 weeks of every senior year, and for most students, it's not a very productive time to begin with, and have a 6 one-hour-a-piece curriculum where a curriculum hour number one, and you can do this from the UMaine Graduate School as kind of this pro bono thing, a quick review of local government. So if you're here in Falmouth and you're a graduating senior for 1 hour in the last month, here's how Falmouth Town Hall works. Here's how school committee works. Here's how the budget is formed. Next hour, the next week or whatever it is, here's how county government, Cumberland County, here's how probate, here's how real estate. In the next week, here's how state government, here's how the branches of state government and the governor works, all the way up to federal budget and judiciary. They're not going to learn every detail, but if a person is familiar enough that they're not intimidated, the chances of them participating is much greater. And our hope for the future isn't 60, 70, 80-year-old people that are so entrenched in whatever they're entrenched with. It's getting young people saying, yeah, I'm going to participate, but it's got to come from knowledge. And I want school systems, not partisan, not, you know, have it be nonpartisan, either a video thing or something else, and just teach kids basic local governmental structure.
Good idea.
Let's do it.
It's a good idea.
I mean, you can be my co-author of the bill.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think the more informed people are, the more likely it is they'll participate.
And if we can get to them where they're on the cusp of first voting, that I think is a very fertile time because it's in their consciousness. You know, in fifth or sixth grade, it's abstract. Here's the way the government works. Here's how the branches work. Here's all that stuff. But if we can get them when they're right on the precipice and say, hey, in June, and without getting over melodramatic, in our democracy, there are men and women right now fighting for our democracy. And with Maine having a high percentage of military involvement, it bothers me when young people, and I don't blame them, I blame adults, the school system, I blame everyone else, but to respect our democracy, our constitution, our freedoms, and the fact that there are brave men and women right now fighting, putting their lives on the line, in many cases getting hurt and dying. And the least we can do when a person is on the precipice of turning 18, say to them, this portal you're about to go through this age requirement, is a really big deal. We think it's such a big deal, we're going to dedicate at least 6 hours teaching you basic stuff. And if you don't want to participate after that, then that's up to you. But we as adults, or we as people who respect government or the Constitution, think it's too important just to let you kind of like, you know, either you're going to vote or not. I'm going to, Deb, remind me to really push this. What do we need to do to get this done?
Well, we've got to do this, because if we're not instilled with that belief that this is an important thing, our country, our independence, et cetera, is not important, then of course we're not going to participate in the voting situation. And then another generation later, even fewer are participating. And
yeah.
Then what happens?
It just gets recycled. And if every kid only hears their parents or adults claim, oh, the government's messed up or the government's this. I actually, another confession, Deb.
Oh, boy.
I like government. I don't like wasteful government. I don't like big government. But when you look at the complexity of our society and the fact that lights work, we have, you know, for the most part, clean water systems. There's a road out there. The traffic signal keeps people from banging into each other. And you look at it all and you go, man, this is kind of unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But we've gotten to this point where there's a popular view of government's bad. I don't know. How do you feel about government, Elliot? Are you a fan?
Well, let me tell you how I feel today. It had been 35 years since I last worked in a public bureaucracy. And it's different. I got an office, but it took me 2 months and 2 weeks.
Okay.
I'm just playing games. I've spent about a third of my career, I guess, in public service or in attempting to be in public service. And I think it's terribly important, really important. And we're not going to survive as a democracy without people engaging in public service who believe in it. And what I'm doing right now is trying to put us in a stronger position to educate people for both public and private service. It's important. You're absolutely right.
As we finish up here, we have Elliot Cutler in the studio. You're listening to News Talk, WLOB 1310. It looked like when you took on the role of CEO of the Graduate Center that it was an 18-month contract. Is the goal of your assignment now to kind of set the stage on what can be done going forward, and then hopefully there'll be a phase two where
we build it,
where you build it. Is that what the timeline looks like?
I have until September of next year to come up with a blueprint, a business model to describe what it's going to be and how it'll work and how we'll pay for it, how we're going to pull the capital together to make it work. And then, assuming what I've developed persuades the chancellor and the board of trustees of the university system and investors in it, outside investors, then we'll go ahead and build it.
Great. Well, I wish you a lot of luck. I think that, as you said, education is not a chicken or egg thing. It's just fundamental to everything in kind of an organized, healthy, civilized society, and economics plays a big part of that. And as much as Maine may resist it, we're part of a global economy, and we need to have global understanding and education and awareness. We can't just be parochial. And I wish you luck in the new assignment.
You. Thanks.
You
good
bet.
To be here today. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Anyone looking for more information, where can they find out about the Graduate Center? Is just through the UMaine website?
And you know, there's limited information there's on the website right now, but if they wait 3 or 4 months, there'll be a lot.
That'll be fantastic. Well, you've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. That was Elliot Cutler doing some great things in the university system. We will be back next week. Thank you.